Welcome back to Southeast Asia Radio. We'll cover corruption in Malaysia, anti-Marcos protests in the Philippines, and more in today's headlines. We're also discussing some economic developments in Malaysia as the price of the ringgit continues to sink. I'm Jaffet Kitson. Today is March 4th, 2024. On today's interview...
My piece is really about how Southeast Asian countries have really been part of the telegraphic cables and then that fiber optic cable network since really the 19th century. And this is a little known fact in the region, I think. It certainly was a new fact to me. And now that we're so entrenched in this network of subsea cables that supposedly carries 99% of internet traffic around the world, we not only benefit from it, but we also are vulnerable to many of the risks that underpin a lot of these subsea cables, and we can go into that later.
Greg Poling chatted with Alina Noor about her latest report, Entangled: Southeast Asia and the Geopolitics of Undersea Cables. Before that, let's start with the headlines. Hey Lauren, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing good. Let's get started with our first headline. On February 25th, hundreds marched to Manila to mark the anniversary of the 1986 People Power Revolution that ousted Ferdinand Marcos Sr. The demonstrators vowed to prevent his son, Marcos Jr., from repeating the dictatorship.
This comes after Marcos Jr.'s allies in the House and Senate ramp up campaigns to alter the ensuing 1987 Freedom Constitution.
The protests rejected charter change moves which could potentially allow Marcos Jr. to remain in power by adjusting the existing six-year one-term limit to the Philippine presidency.
Meanwhile, Marcos and his allies maintain that they are mainly seeking to amend the charter's economic provisions to allow more foreign investment and create more jobs.
Let's not forget, though, Marcos did comment on the alteration of term limits in the Philippine Constitution. He noted that the political aspects, including term limits, should be tackled later on.
This didn't stop protesters from chanting no to cha-cha or no to charter change and wearing shirts and hats that vow never again.
Right. So many protesters felt like they were watching history repeat itself under Marcos Jr.
Another vocal opponent of charter change is former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, creating a very public rift between the Duterte and Marcos camps.
The Duterte-Marcos feud demonstrates how political alliances in the Philippines are often short-lived and instituted simply for politicians to make political gains ahead of elections. Let's look across the South China Sea to Malaysia, where PM Anwar Ibrahim's government confronted its own protest rally.
On February 27th, BERSI, an electoral watchdog organization, organized a rally near Malaysia's National Monument, attended by representatives from over 60 NGOs.
The group called on the Prime Minister to implement reforms he had promised as an opposition leader, including those related to combating corruption and eliminating unfair electoral practices.
Protesters also voiced concerns over recent acquittals and prison term reductions of indicted former politicians, including former PM Najib Razak.
It was an ironic twist for Anwar, who had participated in rallies previously organized by BERSI, including a 2011 mega rally attended by hundreds of thousands of people.
And the protests went on despite the fact that Anwar's government has been ramping up its anti-graft probe of prominent personalities, including former finance minister Daim Zainuddin, former PM Mahathir Mohamad's two sons, and former PM Muhyiddin Yassin and his son-in-law.
Still, the choice of targets has not escaped controversy. Yassin complained that Anwar was orchestrating a political vendetta, while Mahathir said on social media that his family is being politically victimized.
These statements broaden accusations about the increasingly authoritarian nature of Anwar's government, including by former allies and supporters.
Most recently, journalists and media watchdog organizations have complained that Malaysia's updated Code of Ethics for Journalists may curb media freedom.
Released on February 20th, the Code of Ethics was developed by the Information Department under the Ministry of Communications, raising concerns about new forms of state control under Anwar's cabinet.
The government, for their part, argued that the code will assist in combating fake news, defamation, and other issues related to the advent of social media.
Moving forward, Anwar's government seems like it has lots to juggle, from supporters and detractors alike. For our final topic today, we're looking at recent updates in Southeast Asia's response to the situation in Gaza.
Recently, Singapore's former president, Halimah Yacob, made a strongly worded Facebook post saying that the ceaseless suffering in Gaza represented the degradation of the human soul.
Yacob's call for people to stand on the side of humanity received support from others in Singapore, including a repost from Minister for Law and Home Affairs, K. Shanmugam.
Yaakob's emotional statement is atypical for politicians from Singapore, but with recent criticism for how Singapore is teaching about the war in schools, it might be an unofficial channel to express frustration with Singapore's approach to the conflict.
Always a friend of all in its foreign policy, Singapore has condemned both Hamas's October 7th assault on southern Israel, as well as the rising death toll in Gaza.
Other Southeast Asian nations have been a bit more vocal in their stances.
In late February, Indonesia called on the ICJ to deliver an advisory opinion to stop what they consider Israel's unlawful occupation in the Gaza Strip.
Indonesia's support for Palestine goes back decades. Indonesia was the first country to recognize the state of Palestine in 1988 and has no formal diplomatic ties with Israel.
The stance aligns with the strong pro-Palestinian views of Indonesians across the Muslim-majority country.
Right. Many in Indonesia are participating in a boycott of international companies accused of financing Israel.
We're seeing this trend in Malaysia, too.
Boycotts throughout the country are bringing down revenue in businesses in Malaysia seen with links to the U.S. and Israel.
In some cases, it seems to be working, though some still found it too neutral. Starbucks Malaysia recently broke its silence on the conflict with a statement condemning violence and the loss of life.
On the other hand, there has also been some trouble with pro-Palestine organizing in Malaysia.
Malaysia's Kuala Lumpur High Court is charging leaders of a local pro-Palestinian NGO for misappropriating some US $17 million sourced from the public donations.
The NGO claims to provide emergency, welfare, and humanitarian aid to Palestinians for as long as they remain in conflict with Israel.
But 4 kilograms of gold bars at the organization's office have cast doubts and sparked a sense of betrayal amongst Malaysians seeking to do what they can to support the Palestinian cause.
It's definitely an issue many in Southeast Asia have passionate opinions about. We'll be keeping an eye on it for sure. And those were our headlines. Up next, Greg talks to Alina about her latest report on undersea cables. So stay tuned.
Welcome back to Southeast Asia Radio. As always, I'm Greg Poling with the Center for Strategic International Studies, joined by co-host Alina Noor with the Carnegie Endowment. Howdy, Alina.
Hi, Greg. Welcome back from your travels.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm fresh from 2 weeks in the region, Australia, Thailand, and the Philippines, and coming down with a bit of a cold courtesy of a packed flight back. So hopefully I stay lucid for the next 20-ish minutes to record this. Anywho, our special guest today is, let me check my notes, why, it's Alina Noor of the Carnegie Endowment. Hey again, Alina.
What? Nobody told me this.
And today we're going to talk about Alina's newly published report, Entangled, Southeast Asia and the Geopolitics of Undersea Cables. I don't think we've done an episode on undersea cables so far. We've done digital economy a couple times and AI, but this is going to be new for us. So, Alina, what's the thesis of the article? What's going on with undersea cables in the region?
In choosing the title for my piece, I was trying to go for a Disney theme. And Frozen came to mind, but given the waters of Southeast Asia are generally warm, I decided to go with Entangled instead. That, however, is not the thesis of my piece, thankfully. My piece is really about how Southeast Asian countries have really been part of the telegraphic cables and then that fiber optic cable network since really the 19th century. And this is a little known fact in the region, I think. It certainly was a new fact to me. And now that we're so entrenched in this network of subsea cables that supposedly carries 99% of internet traffic around the world, we not only benefit from it, but we also are vulnerable to many of the risks that underpin a lot of these subsea cables. And we can go into that later. But the risks are not only physical damage to the subsea cables, but also like geopolitical risks that many discussions on subsea cables in Southeast Asia don't generally cover. It's all about the economy. It's all about investment in subsea cables, but we don't actually seriously reflect on some of the risks that are actually being brought out by allegedly the attacks by the Houthis on cables in the Red Sea now. So basically, we have these risks surrounding subsea cables, but Southeast Asian countries are not sufficiently or adequately talking about it.
Okay. First of all, let me break in. I don't know if you actually picked the name as a reference to Tangled, but as the father of a six-year-old and one who grew up during the pandemic, I'm having terrible flashbacks. Not only have I seen Tangled many times, I had to watch all of the Disney shorts and the, I think, two or three seasons of the Disney TV show more than once that serve as a sequel to the actual movie.
So it was meant to be provocative on many levels, and I'm glad it delivered.
Okay, I really appreciate that. So undersea cables are like the evil black rocks that make up the plot line of the Disney show, for those who haven't seen it. Okay, on to more important matters. Before we get to the 21st century, you've got this whole interesting intro about Southeast Asia's role in 19th century telegraph cables. So why was Southeast Asia so central to the birth of the telegraphic network in the 19th century?
So surprise, surprise, Southeast Asian countries had these resources that were really crucial to insulating the telegraphic cables in the 19th century. And those telegraphic cables were mainly from the center of the British Empire to other European capitals, and they provided. So if you speak Malay or Indonesian, you'll know that the word getah means rubber. And there's a specific species of rubber trees in Southeast Asia called getah percha. And getah percha was this latex that was the main insulant for these telegraphic cables. So Southeast Asia provided the raw materials for these telegraphic cables.
And the getah percha tree almost went extinct as a result.
Almost went extinct. Yeah, the yield from each tree was so inadequate given all the labor that went into it. And it nearly caused a large-scale environmental destruction of that particular species of trees.
Okay. This is not necessarily directly relevant to today's issues. Just before we get into U.S.-China competition, I wanted to frame a British problem to start off the conversation.
It's indirectly related, right? Because it goes to the heart of how Southeast Asia has always been in the middle of these power dynamics.
Yes, but it's always useful to deflect by blaming the Brits before we get into what's going on in U.S.-China competition.
You said it, not me.
That's fine. Now, let's get to the part where we blame the U.S. and China. Can you pick apart a little bit the, you know, kind of unenviable, although maybe a little bit enviable position of Southeast Asian states now as we see this bifurcation of cable networks, current undersea cable networks between the U.S. and China? How does the region try to mitigate the risks while maybe maximizing benefits in this competition?
Yeah, where to start? So one of the examples that I pick on in my piece goes back to about 20 years. And this relates to the bankruptcy case of a company known as Global Crossings at the time, which was basically kind of the main supplier of cables stretching five continents and 200 plus countries, I think. So when Global Crossings folded, there was interest by a Singaporean company and a Hong Kong-based company in buying it out. But the U.S. government decided that there would be too much risk in a Hong Kong-based company having a stake in whatever the new iteration of this company would be. And so the Singaporean company ended up buying over two-thirds of shares in Global Crossings. But the U.S. insisted that there be a number of conditions attached to that purchase because it touched on U.S. interests. And some of those conditions included things like the setting up of a subsidiary that would have a board of directors comprised of former U.S. officials still holding security clearance, that would have kind of a network operations center that U.S. government officials could visit within a 30-minute notice. And so from even 20 years back, you saw some of these backroom decisions being made that would impact the functional utility of submarine cables that crisscross the whole world. Fast forward to 20 years on, you see the same kinds of dynamics in place. There is an intergovernment agency that is unofficially known as Team Telecoms that comprises a number of U.S. key agencies, including the US DOJ, including defense, I think, and some homeland security. And so this interagency group has a lot of say on what happens with subsea cables because it touches on US interests. Another modern day example I draw on is kind of the Pacific Light Cable Network that was initially conceived of as directly connecting Hong Kong to Los Angeles, but had to be rerouted for national security reasons to bypass the Hong Kong landing point. And so Pacific Light Cable Network will now instead be routed through other Southeast Asian countries, which goes to your point, Greg, about countries in the region benefiting from this, whether in terms of actually getting the bandwidth or in terms of investment. So, you know, pros and cons. Kind of my long answer to your question.
Yeah. And most of the major cables being laid at the moment are being controlled by the major Western multinationals, right? Meta, Alphabet / Google. And so the need to diversify away from China to avoid landings in Hong Kong or the mainland, I assume that is a net benefit to South Asia, right? We are seeing more landings in South Asian countries than we otherwise would have.
That is true, but I don't know if that's a function of these developments. I think it's a natural outgrowth of the fact that there is a demand for bandwidth in Southeast Asia that's ever growing. But I don't know if the benefits outweigh the costs, honestly, because a lot of discussion, as I mentioned in the beginning, in Southeast Asia, around subsea cables has been on kind of the investment opportunities, employment opportunities. We haven't really talked about kind of the national security risks to Southeast Asia. A lot of these subsea cables are underpinned by national security agreements that companies like Google and Meta have with the US government. And those agreements, they cover US citizens, US persons. They don't extend to other nationalities, other countries. And so it falls to the shoulders of Southeast Asian governments to provide those similar protections to their citizens if they're going to be a part of these subsea cable agreements.
So there's, I think, two categories, although maybe you have others, but in my mind, two categories of at least state-backed potential security threats for countries who are dealing with the security of their subsea cables. One is the threat of tampering or cutting cables as punishment or even just as collateral damage in a conflict. And we hear this in the context of the South China Sea a lot. I know the Philippines gets worried about this, right? We want to minimize, if you're the Philippines, you want to minimize your reliance on subsea cables to Hong Kong or the mainland, because what if China gets angry enough at you to sever them? And then the second that you're talking about is the threat of violations of data privacy, scraping up your citizens' data, et cetera, for which the U.S. presumably feels some degree of safety, because since the Edward Snowden revelations, it's become legally more difficult for the U.S. government to just scoop up data on most Americans. But the U.S. government is still totally free to scoop up data on the citizens of every other country on Earth. So diversifying cables away from China might benefit the U.S. on both of those counts, but only clearly benefits Southeast Asia hypothetically on one of them. Just means that only the U.S. can spy on Southeast Asia. Is that a fair way to frame it if you were a cynic in Southeast Asia?
Absolutely. And I am a Southeast Asian cynic, so that is fair. The two categories of risks that you pointed out, I think, are accurate, unless I'm missing others. So there's a physical risk of damage to those cables themselves. We saw, you know, Vietnam between 2022 and 2023 had all five of their cables damaged in some way. And so that meant that a lot of the country's internet was offline for a bit. But there's also a real risk of basically parties tapping into the data that flows through these cables. Now, I need to understand that with fiber optic cables, it's very difficult to tap into those cables underwater. Not completely impossible, but extremely difficult. The vulnerabilities are at the landing points themselves. And so those risks still stand, because if Southeast Asian countries are more than willing to have the territory situated for landing points of these cables, then the governments need to put in place the adequate safeguards and protections for their own citizen data.
This in some way mirrors some of the conversations we had now 5 years ago on 5G, where the U.S. would go out and they would tell partners and allies, hey, over-reliance on Chinese partners as part of the infrastructure for your 5G network is an inherent threat because it will allow China backdoors to spy on you. And that worked in some cases, mainly U.S. allies. But what we would hear from the Malaysian government at the time, from the Singaporean government was, well, but you spy on us too. So what do we care? As long as we know who's spying on us, we feel like we can mitigate the risks. And I think the U.S. was a bit taken aback by that. I mean, we shouldn't have been in the wake of the Snowden revelations, but it's something we've never really had a good counter to. And I see this similar argument. The U.S. is going to say, well, but we don't spy. Okay, we do. But if we do, it's not for nefarious reasons. You just have to trust us. And that's a hard argument to make in a anarchic international system in the wake of Snowden.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it's partially why you don't hear as many discussions on these national security risks in Southeast Asia, I feel. Because the sentiment is, well, you know, everybody's spying on us. One spy is not necessarily better than the other. And so the risks are equal in the eyes of many Southeast Asian governments.
Yeah, no, the argument that we're the good spies is hard to make, at least in non-aligned states. All right, so you are a Southeast Asian country, and your top concern is not China intentionally severing your cables. So basically, if you're not the Philippines, what do you do about this?
You begin to have a discussion, a broader discussion, on the criticality of subsea cables beyond just through economic lens, right? And so one of my recommendations is to set up at the national level of countries that are willing to do this, have an interagency council that comprises a number of agencies in the national security realm, in the economics and trade realm, and maybe you'd want to bring in some non-government officials, definitely industry stakeholders, to have a broad-ranging, comprehensive discussion on what it means to have subsea cables land in your territory, but also discuss kind of the risks and ways ahead to protect the cables when they're at risk. There is an emerging debate on treating subsea cables as critical infrastructure, which has all sorts of implications for public-private partnerships.
I assume that would, at least in some markets in Southeast Asia, Philippines comes to mind, it would open up questions about the degree of foreign ownership, which would be difficult in a commercial space in which there's only a handful of international companies that have the capital and the technical know-how to lay subsea cables across the ocean.
Exactly. And then that would have ripple effects on what kinds of subsidies are available to these companies, given how costly these cables are.
Do you think Southeast Asian governments have the leverage and the ability to negotiate regimes that would mitigate the concerns on spying and data privacy?
I think, first of all, there has to be awareness and a will to have a discussion on this issue. That will can come at the national level, perhaps in closed-door settings. And then when companies and countries are familiar and comfortable with the issues, then they can possibly have a discussion at the ASEAN level about this. I know this is a bit of a far-fetched idea, but I think there should be some beginnings of a discussion on this given the geopolitical climate we're in.
And you think ASEAN is the right place, or is it just the only place to have this conversation?
Certainly not the only place. I think it's a starting point for a discussion at the regional level, given how connected Southeast Asian countries are to each other, but also how much of a choke point the region is for a number of these cables. I think what needs to be determined is what kinds of platforms at the ASEAN level would be adequate and appropriate for this type of discussion. Maybe there can be a discussion amongst the Sherpas of the ASEAN Digital Ministers meeting, for example.
When it comes to mitigating threats and maximizing benefits, are we also seeing more conversation about resiliency, as we've seen examples like Kinmen and Matsu last year and Tonga, where countries that were wholly or at least overly dependent on a single cable saw that cable damaged either because of intentional sabotage or natural disaster.
Yeah, I think there is definitely an appetite for some geographical diversity of these cables. One of the fallouts from geopolitical competition in and around Southeast Asia with regard to subsea cables is the fact that, I go into this a bit in my piece, is that the Simiui cable, so if I get this right, Southeast Asia, Middle East, Western Europe cable, that was originally...
Good job, by the way.
Thank you. There's so many acronyms. It's, oh my God, it's confounding. But this particular stretch of cable was almost certainly to be handed to Huawei Marine Technologies for construction. But then the USS Team Telecom got involved behind the scenes. And so the contract to construct that cable was awarded to a New Jersey-based company instead, Subcom. As a result of that, the Chinese companies pulled out of the conglomerate and decided that they would build their own cables in a parallel line that goes to more or less similar, same countries as the Simiui cable. So this, I think, is a bit of a boon for countries in the region because now you have redundancy if the Chinese cable comes alive. But at the same time, you know, there's a cost as well. And here I'm talking about financial costs, right? So whether countries that are invested in one cable can afford to invest in another cable to ensure that redundancy and resiliency is going to be a huge factor. So again, like there are all these different factors to weigh. You want to have resilience, you want to have redundancy, but can you afford it is going to be a big question mark.
Does the attraction of more landings become somewhat zero-sum for the region? I'm thinking, for instance, of the way that attracting data processing centers became a bit zero-sum, right? If you build your data processing center in Indonesia, you're not going to build another one in Malaysia or vice versa. And presumably, if you make a cable landing in the Philippines, you're not then going to need to make another one in Indonesia. So does that competition threaten to undermine the regional collaboration that you think is necessary?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Thanks for bringing that up. This was a huge point of contention that made national news in Malaysia when Google and Meta decided to have their cables land in Singapore and Indonesia instead of Malaysia. And a lot of discussion in Malaysia blamed the Malaysian government's cabotage policy. My own sense was that there wasn't enough discussion on kind of the national security risks of having those cables have their landing points in Malaysia. But again, you see the considerations around subsea cables and where they land very heavily premised on kind of economic and investment opportunities. So by having those cables routed through Indonesia and Singapore, Malaysia has lost out in terms of investment and employment opportunities. So yes, I think it would hamper real and meaningful regional collaboration.
And that's cabotage being the legal requirement to use Malaysian flag vessels within the country.
So technically, it's not a requirement. It prioritizes Malaysian vessels over others.
Okay. To harken way back and show my age, this reminds me of the fury in Indonesia now more than 10 years ago when BlackBerry built its only regional headquarters in Malaysia instead of in Indonesia, even though Indonesia was the largest market on earth for RIM headsets at the time.
Really? I did not know this.
Yeah, this was 2011, 2012, and probably not long before RIM went bankrupt everywhere except for Indonesia. With that, let's wrap it for this week. Thank you very much to our special guest, Alina Noor. And as always, thank you to my co-host, Alina Noor. And thanks all of you for listening. We'll be back in a couple weeks with the next episode of Southeast Asia Radio.
From my two personas, thank you, Greg.
Thank you again for joining us for this episode of Southeast Asia Radio. Write us with any comments, questions, or feedback at searadio@csis.org, and we'll get back to you.
Do us a favor and subscribe. Give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever streaming platform you listen to us on. Tell your friends about us.
Marla Hiller is our producer, and our interns are Angus Lamb, Corey Donnelly, and Tappy Lung. Our co-hosts today were Greg Poling and Alina Noor. My name is Jaffet Kitson.
And I'm Lauren Mai.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks for another episode of Southeast Asia Radio.